Exodus chapter 7 verse 8 to chapter 8 verse 19. The 11th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on July 10, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in a reduction in sound quality for the last several minutes of the teaching.
Today what I want to do is, since it's been a while, I want to start out with a brief recap of what we've done in Exodus so far. Then I'm going to make just some introductory comments about the plagues as a whole, and then we will work our way through the text that talks about the first three plagues. As you will recall, the Israelites were in Egypt. They went down to Egypt because there had been a famine in Canaan and throughout the Middle East, and the only place that there was food available was in Egypt. And the only reason that there was food available in Egypt was because God had informed Joseph by means of a dream that there were going to be 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of famine. And Joseph was made the number two man in Egypt and put in charge of saving the abundance of crops so that there would be food when the famine hit. And Joseph, as you will recall, was in Egypt because his brothers had sold him into slavery, and he was taken down to Egypt as a slave, and God blessed him there and made it possible for him to rise to the number two position in Egypt. So when that happened, the entire clan moved down from Canaan to Egypt and settled there. It was 70 some odd people in all that made their way from Canaan into Egypt and settled on the eastern edge of Egypt. The action in the book of Exodus picks up about 400 years later. So a long time has passed. And it says that a new king arose in Egypt. It's not clear whether that is talking about a new dynasty or whether we're talking about a whole different people group. Because during those 400 years, a different people group came in and conquered Egypt for a period of time and reigned. Their kings reigned over Egypt. But then they were finally driven out. And it's possible that it's after that happened then that the action in Exodus begins. In any case, there has been a changeover in leadership in Exodus. A new king has come to power. And this king is looking out at the Israelites, and he sees danger because there are so many of them. When they came down, there were 70, but now there are a lot of them. And the Pharaoh's concerned that there are so many that they could rebel and they could rise up against the Egyptians. So he, using his intelligence, decides that the best way to deal with this is to force the Israelites into harsh labor, making bricks for his building projects. But that forcing them into harsh labor doesn't solve the problem. They continue to have more children. They continue to increase in numbers. As a result, he has another idea. He calls in the midwives of the Hebrews, and he tells them, anytime a boy is born, kill it. The midwives do not act on the Pharaoh's instructions. They refuse to do so. And as a result, the number of Israelites continues to grow. The Pharaoh's second attempt at trying to reduce their numbers and their potential of rebellion fails. So the third time, he enlists the whole Egyptian society, And he says, if a Hebrew boy is born, take him and throw him in the river, throw him in the Nile. He'll drown, and that will work, is what he's thinking. When that decree is under effect, there is a child that is born to a Levite couple, both of them of Levite lineage. The child is born, a boy, and the mother decides that she is going to take that child and put him in a basket and stick him in the Nile River, and in hopes that he will be saved. So he's put into the Nile River, and his sister, who couldn't have been very old, would have been probably a young teenager, is given the assignment of keeping watch on this floating basket in the Nile. The daughter of the Pharaoh comes down to the Nile to bathe. She finds the basket with a child in it, recognizes that it's a Hebrew child, but she wants to adopt it as her own. Moses' sister, Moses is the name of the child, Moses' sister comes running down and says, you're probably going to need a nurse for this child. I know someone who could do that job. And so Moses' mother then was giving charge of nursing and raising that child in its early years. That child is named Moses, and Moses is raised in a difficult situation. On the one hand, he is an Israelite. He clearly knows he's an Israelite and identifies very strongly with his people. And that presumably is the result of the upbringing by his mother. His mother has undoubtedly told him stories and taught him about who he is and who his people are. But on the other hand, he's the adopted child of the Pharaoh's daughter. He's raised in the court, has a privileged upbringing, is very well educated, and is given the kind of education that you would give to a future ruler. When he's 40 years old, he's feeling the tension of his background. That is to say, he is an Israelite on the one hand, but he was raised like an Egyptian. He has kind of no home group that he fully identifies with. And I talked about that before, the phenomenon of the rootless intellectuals. But as a result, I am convinced that he was raised, he grew up with the expectation that he was going to do something great for the Israelite people. He had a privileged upbringing, and he had a miraculous beginning, and I'm convinced that he was thinking all along, I am going to do something great for my people. So when he's 40 years old, he goes out and he is observing the Israelites as they're working as slave laborers, and an Egyptian taskmaster beats up one of the slaves, and Moses witnesses this happening. And Moses looks for an opportunity when he can jump this Egyptian who had beat up an Israelite, and he kills this Egyptian and buries him, thinking that he has pulled off a murder that was not witnessed by anyone. The next day, he's again out and about where the Israelites are working, and there is a conflict between two Israelites. And he intervenes, thinking that this isn't right, that two Israelites would be fighting. And as we see, Moses is one who is concerned about justice. We see that consistently in his life. So he sees this happening. He wants to right this wrong. He intervenes. And one of the Israelites, the one who is in the wrong, says, who made you the boss of me? What makes you think that you are a prince or a ruler over me? And then he said, are you going to kill me too, like you did the Egyptian? So when that is said, I am convinced Moses is deeply hurt, because he was seeing himself as a savior for his people, and yet he can see his people are not going to accept as having authority, as having any kind of position in their society. And he knows that the word is out, he was seen, and there are people who saw it that are not reluctant to talk about it. So he flees. He runs away. He runs to the east, and he goes a long ways. He goes to Midian. And he arrives in Midian and is at a well where these young women have poured out water for their sheep. And some shepherds come, and they drive out these young girls so that they can water their sheep using the water that the young women had poured out. And he intervenes. An injustice has been done, and he intervenes. And he drives the shepherds away, and he helps the young women water their herds. It turns out that these young women are the daughters of a priest of Midian, Reuel. And Reuel invites Moses to join them, which he does. He goes and lives with them, and he ends up marrying one of Reuel's daughters as his own wife. Then there are 40 years that he spends in Midian, and nothing about that is recorded. So it's 50 years of spinning his wheels. So if you think about it, here's someone who at the age of 40 was expecting that he was going to be the savior of his people, the Israelites, but is rejected by them, goes into the desert, and for 40 years he's doing nothing. There's nothing of significance that he's doing. And in fact, he isn't even growing wealthy like the patriarchs did. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they all became wealthy. When we see Moses again, he is shepherding his father-in-law's flocks. There's not even indication that he has his own flocks. So 40 years have passed. He's 80 years old at this point. He is shepherding flocks at the mountain of God. It's called the mountain of God. It's Mount Sinai. And he sees a phenomenal sight. He sees a bush that's on fire, but the bush is not being consumed. And he turns aside to see what this sight is. And God speaks to him out of the bush, says, "Take off your shoes. You're on holy ground. And don't come nearer." Moses does so, and God speaks to him, and God explains to him, "I am going to use you. You are going to go back to Egypt, and you are going to lead your people out of Egypt, out of slavery, out of Egypt." And Moses doesn't want to do it. Moses three times says, "Nope, I'm not the person for the job." And God explains who he is and what he's up to. And Moses says, "No, I'm not the one." And I'm convinced here that Moses has, over these 40 years, he's decided, you know, I was wrong. I was not given the assignment of leading my people out of Egypt. And he has resolved himself to that. And in fact, it seems to me, Moses has decided, I don't even identify with that people anymore. I'm a Midianite. I'm not an Israelite. He is fully integrated into his situation in Midian. But God says, "I'm going to give you signs that you can show to the people." Moses says, "Well, that's not going to do it because I can't talk." And God says, "Well, I'm going to give you someone who can talk. Your brother Aaron will speak for you." Moses says, send somebody else. And God says, "Go. I'm sending you." So Moses packs up, he and his family, and they start towards Egypt. And then there's a very strange little piece of narrative in which, as I understand it, Moses gets deathly ill. Right after he's told to go back to Egypt, he gets deathly ill. God strikes him with a disease, with some kind of sickness. And it isn't until his wife circumcises their son, Gershom, and takes the foreskin and places it on against Moses' foot that he is healed. And I think the point there is Moses has distanced himself from his people to the extent that Gershom is not even circumcised. His son is not even circumcised. And what has to happen before he returns to Egypt is he has to fully identify with his people Israel. And I think that that's the point of that little strange little section. Then he meets Aaron. They together return to Egypt. And Moses and Aaron do exactly as God had instructed them to do. They go and meet with the people of Israel, and they present the signs that God had given. And the people of Israel are very impressed, and they believe that Moses has been sent by God. They do. They believe now. Then Moses and Aaron, they go and speak to Pharaoh, and they say, let us go. Let us go 3 days' journey from here to offer sacrifices to our God, because if we don't go, God will punish us. And Pharaoh's response to that is, I am going to enforce harsher enslavement, harsher punishment on the Israelites. They are going to have to make their bricks without straw. They can gather their own straw, make the bricks, but they have to make the same quota that they had made before. So it's much harder labor, much more difficult for them to do. And as a result, the Israelite foremen go to Pharaoh and they say, we can't do this. You don't understand. This is too much. You're killing us. And Pharaoh says, get out of here. And they leave and inform Moses and Aaron of Pharaoh's response. And they accuse Moses of having made things worse. Their situation is worse now than it had been when Moses first arrived. The very thing that Moses didn't want to happen. The worst thing that could have happened from Moses' perspective. So Moses implores God, please, please deal with the situation and deliver your people. So it's at that point then that we re-enter the narrative. So looking at chapter 7, verses 8 through 13. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. It's not clear to me why it was that Pharaoh was willing to receive them and to listen to them. But however that happened, Moses and Aaron were able to arrange an audience with the Pharaoh. And God had told them when he asks for a miracle that you are supposed to do the first sign. So God is anticipating that that will be Pharaoh's request. Now, if you think about Moses' situation, he's going to go in to ask Pharaoh, the ruler of the most powerful country in the world at the time, to let his slaves go free, to go off for 3 days into the wilderness to offer sacrifices. On what basis does he make that appeal? On what basis is that going to be the least bit compelling to Pharaoh? Clearly, Moses is not going to be able to make a moral argument and say it's immoral for you to have slaves, you need to let them go. That would have had no traction in the ancient world. Slavery was very common, widely accepted, and by no means considered to be immoral. So his only basis for making this appeal is going to be that Moses is representing some divine power that has power over the Pharaoh, over Egypt in some way. So he's going to have to bring credentials that make that plausible. So it's going to be signs and wonders that he's going to have to bring to get Pharaoh to even consider what they're saying. God recognizes that, and God has provided a sign for them to produce. So Aaron, and notice that it's Aaron who is doing this, the arrangement that was made was that Moses would have a spokesman, Aaron, who would speak for him, and that's what's happening here. Aaron takes the staff. This is the staff, presumably, that Moses had when he was a shepherd in Midian, throws it down on the ground, and when he throws it down on the ground, it becomes a serpent. Pharaoh, and there are obviously a lot of people observing this, and Pharaoh calls in his magicians and his sorcerers to see this, and he tells them, I want you to reproduce this wonder. And the sorcerers, the magicians of Egypt, they are each able to take a staff, throw it on the ground, and it becomes a serpent. Now there is, in the commentaries, it talks about this, a phenomenon. There is a certain kind of snake that when it is pinched at a certain place, that the serpent, it goes stiff. And as long as pressure is applied on that nerve, it continues to be stiff. As soon as pressure is released from that nerve, then it begins to move again. And apparently this is a trick that had been done in that part of the world, and apparently is still done in that part of the world. My assumption is, from the way that the narrative is laid out, that the staff that Aaron has thrown down was a genuine staff, and it turns into a genuine serpent. So I'm assuming that this is a supernatural event that has taken place. Whereas what the magicians are doing is, by their trickery, that serpent could be the serpent that becomes rigid, that could account for how they were able to reproduce this. We're going to see that there are other times that the magicians are able to replicate what Aaron does. But in each case, it is my assumption that what they do is a cheap imitation of the thing that Aaron performs. The fact that it is a cheap imitation is demonstrated when the serpent that came from Aaron's staff swallows up the serpents of the other magicians, indicating that Aaron's staff, it has dominance over the tricks of the magicians. And then it says, yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So there's no flexibility here. The Pharaoh is convinced that there's nothing that Moses and Aaron have to offer that shake his faith in his own power and the power of Egypt. As a result, then, God commands Moses to bring about the first of the 10 plagues. Verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourselves to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in the vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. So this is the first of the 10 plagues. So this is the beginning of this competition, a grand competition that's going on between Pharaoh and ultimately Yahweh. Now it's to be understood that Pharaoh is a power to be reckoned with. He was the king of the most powerful country in the world, arguably, the most powerful country of the world. And he was thought by his society, by his culture, to be a god himself. He was the son of God who was living on earth among his people. When he dies, he goes into full divinity, but he is a god himself. Furthermore, he is seen as an intermediary between his people and the divine forces. And it is his job, and it is all of Egypt is counting on him to keep chaos at bay and allow nature and society to continue in an orderly fashion. Let me take just a minute to explain that. In the ancient world, the thinking was that chaos is the natural state. If the world were left to be on its own, it would be chaotic. It would be destructive. There would be pain and suffering always, darkness, flooding, etc., etc. It is because of the God's activity that that chaos is at all kept in check. That's what they do for mankind, is they keep that chaos in check. And in Egypt, it is helpful to envision the reality that they are in a very privileged geographical location on the banks of the Nile. If they go 10 miles from the Nile, they're in the desert. They're in an area where death comes quickly. So it's just this strip of water and the land on both sides of it that make life possible for them, and it's a good life. But beyond that, it's deadly. And they're aware of that. The chaos is just beyond the Nile, just a little ways away. And Pharaoh's job is to be an intermediary between his people and the gods such that they will keep that chaos 10 miles away from them. Yahweh, on the other hand, who's Yahweh? When Moses and Aaron say, "We have come in the name of Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews," I mean, that is no claim at all of any significance, because it was generally understood throughout the ancient world that each people has a god that watches over them, or gods, set of gods that watch over them, and that the well-being of any given people is dependent upon the power that that god or those gods have. So the more powerful your gods, the better off your country will be, and the more powerful your country will be, your army will be, etc. So Moses and Aaron are coming in the name of Yahweh, the God of slaves. That's not impressive, and Pharaoh would have been well aware of that. Furthermore, it would appear that Yahweh isn't even well known to his own people. They were not yet made into a people. They didn't yet have their own unique culture and worship practices. God had made himself known to the patriarchs, but it would appear that that was not passed down well to the people since then. So any reasonable person looking at this situation is going to judge that Pharaoh and his gods are going to dominate in whatever contest takes place here. And this contest is going to start out with Aaron and Moses making quite modest demands. They just want to go 3 days into the wilderness in order to offer sacrifices. And they are going to use 3 less impressive wonders to begin with. But as we go on through the plagues, they will become more spectacular and more deadly as we progress into the 10 plagues. And what we're going to see is that as we progress through, Pharaoh is going to dig his heels in, and he's going to dig them in harder and harder as time goes on. We'll talk about that more later. But in the end, God will completely defeat him and humiliate him, and he's going to lead his people out of Egypt in safety. Okay. Now, as we talk about the plagues, this chunk of narrative, it's about 3 chapters, is highly structured, and I'm going to point out some of the structure in it, similar to the creation narrative, which I would argue is also highly structured. That is, how each day is described has a certain pattern, and as there are deviations from that pattern, those deviations become significant. In this case, it's a whole different pattern, but it is a highly patterned description of the 10 plagues. And I'm going to point out some of the patterning so that you can see what I'm talking about. I don't know that I can give you a good reason for places where the pattern is diverged from. And in general, as we go through this section in the narrative in particular, I'm convinced there are a number of elements in this narrative that are significant, and I'm going to point some of them out. I will have a more difficult time telling you what the significance of those details is. But I want to point them out because I think they are significant, and maybe you guys will have some ideas as to what the significance is. Okay, so Aaron and Moses are told to perform this first plague. The first plague is turning the Nile to blood. Notice that was the third of the signs that were given to Moses when he was speaking with God in the bush. So presumably he hasn't performed that until now. He performs it now as the first of the plagues. In the description of this plague, the way in which it is presented is that God speaks to Moses and tells him what he's supposed to do and how that will play out, what that will look like. Then it comes back and says he did it, and this is what it looked like. And both explanations are fairly complete with respect to what this plague is going to look like. I point that out because other plagues will be different from that. Notice also that he is told to go to Pharaoh in the morning as he's going out to the water, station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. Those three elements, we're going to see those again in the fourth plague, and we'll see two of those again in the eighth plague, those three elements. Okay, God had told Moses before he even went that God was going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And we get that statement made, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. That statement is made, I think, a total of 16 times in this section. It also says that his heart is stubborn. That's the same phrase. So that is the condition of Pharaoh's heart. Even going into it, we'll see that it becomes more stubborn. It becomes particularly resistant as time goes on. He's supposed to take the staff in his hand that was turned into a serpent. So this is the same staff, and that's the distinctive thing about this. This staff is going to be, presumably it's the same staff all the way through, but it is pointed out, this is the very same staff that had turned into a serpent. And Moses is supposed to say, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you. And we talked about how unimpressive that would be to Pharaoh. Pharaoh had earlier said, who is Yahweh, when they appeared before him the first time? Who is this God? And one of the themes of this section is it is going to become clear who this Yahweh is. Pharaoh is going to know who this Yahweh is before the 10 plagues are over. So the Nile is going to be turned to blood, and I assume that that means just blood red. And when that happens, fish will die. The water will become foul, and it's going to be hard to find drinking water as a result of this. And it's going to affect all of their water, the rivers, the streams, pools, reservoirs, and even vessels, both stone and wood, that contain water. They are all going to be turned blood red. Okay, verse 20. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded, and he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood, and the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. and 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. So they strike the Nile becomes blood red. And as a result, they can't drink of the water. It's a miserable situation that lasts for 7 days. But Pharaoh says, he calls in his magicians and he says, that's nothing. My magicians can do this. And it's not clear to me exactly how this takes place, because if all of the water has been turned blood red, how do the magicians reproduce this? My best guess is that this is something that they have performed before, and what it's saying is his magicians can do the same. But I don't know. I read one commentary where he describes how this could have happened in a way that they reproduce it. But in any case, Pharaoh is not impressed. He's convinced that this is something that his magicians can do too, and therefore there's no advantage that Yahweh has over him and his gods. So they experience a major inconvenience for 7 days when they have trouble getting water. Now, when we get through all of the plagues, I'm going to talk about whether this is a supernatural event or whether this is an unusual natural event. And there will be much that we can say about that. I'm inclined to think at this point that this is an unusual natural event. And like I say, we'll talk about that when we get to it. And all of these plagues are. Okay, so that is the first of the plagues. The second, Exodus 8, 1 through 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. And the Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into your houses of your servants and on your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. So the frogs will come up on you and your people and all your servants. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians did the same with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Now again, the narrative style in the second plague, it begins with a description of God's complete instructions, what they're supposed to do and what will happen as a result of that. And then it gives a brief description of saying that Moses did it and what happened. So the description of what happened is a little briefer than what we saw in the first plague. And in this way, and how was contact initiated with the Pharaoh? All it says is, go to Pharaoh. And what we'll see is that's the way the second plague is introduced, that's the way the fifth plague is introduced, and that's the way the ninth plague is introduced. Okay, so apparently the request to leave had been repeated and denied, and frogs are everywhere. And this must have been miserable. There are frogs everywhere. They're everywhere outside. They're all over in the house. They're in the ovens, they're in the beds, they're in everything. It's not deadly, but it's a real nuisance. And it is going to affect everybody, as did the first plague. It's going to affect everybody from the highest to the most lowly. It's going to affect everybody. Aaron did it the way that he was told. He stretches out his hand, and I think that means with the staff in hand, he stretches out his hand towards the water, and frogs start coming out of the Nile. It says again that in this case, the magicians were able to reproduce this phenomenon. And again, I'm not sure how you reproduce that. How do you fill a land that's full of frogs with frogs again? But it could be, again, it could be that what's being said is that this is something that the Egyptian magicians were able to do. That is, they had done it before. What's interesting about this to me is Pharaoh is saying to his magicians, do the same thing. Well, having frogs everywhere is miserable. To say to his magicians, do the same thing, is adding misery to misery. What would have been really impressive would be to say to the magicians, get rid of them. But he doesn't say get rid of them. He says, reproduce this. And we're going to see that to the extent that they can reproduce the plagues, it's all bringing greater evil, greater ill. It's not making things better. Okay, next section, verses 8 through 15. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. And Moses said to Pharaoh, the honor is yours to tell me, when shall I entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses, that they may be left only in the Nile? Then he said, tomorrow. So he said, may it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. And the frogs will depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people, and they will be left only in the Nile. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs, which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and the fields. So they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul. But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. So Pharaoh cries uncle. He says, this is terrible. You got to do something. And it is not to his magicians that he turns, but it's to Moses and Aaron that he turns. And he says, remove these frogs. And God says, just tell me when, which is amazing, because this is showing that not only can God do it, but he can name the time when it happens. He can do it when Pharaoh wants it to happen. So Pharaoh says, tomorrow. And Moses says, great, I'll do it. And so the next day then, Moses asks God to remove the frogs, and the frogs start dying everywhere. Well, that doesn't completely take care of the problem. We've got these frogs died everywhere. So they are put into piles, and it's kind of like plowing snow, I think. You put it into piles and you wait for the spring for it to melt. Well, the frogs, they put them into piles and wait for them to decay. So it's stinky. But Pharaoh's response, when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. As soon as there was relief, then he doesn't care about. He doesn't care about Yahweh and who Yahweh is. And we'll see that pattern continue through here. It's only when things are unbearable that he turns to God, and there will even be a confession on his part later on. But as soon as the pressure's off, that is forgotten, is not contrite. The third plague, verse 16. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats through all the land of Egypt. And they did so. And Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats through all the land of Egypt. And the magicians tried with their secret arts to bring forth gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. So this is the third plague. The narrative style of this one is just a brief description of the plague and that they did it, and briefly the results of that. And in this, the third plague, there is no communication with Pharaoh. And that will be true of the seventh plague, and then seventh and ninth. Okay. So God tells Moses, strike the dust with a staff. The dust becomes gnats. There are gnats everywhere. So again, it's a nuisance. It's not deadly, but it is a huge nuisance. This time, this is something that the magicians cannot do. They can't reproduce this. And so the magicians say, we can't continue to compete. We can't keep up with this. This is the finger of God. And at this point, Pharaoh should have recognized that that was the case. But instead of recognizing that that's the case, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. Okay. In this narrative of the plagues, like I said, there's this competition that's going on between the power of God and the power of Pharaoh. And clearly, Pharaoh's power is very limited, and God's power is unlimited. And that's, as we go through, that becomes clearer and clearer. As I have pointed out, Pharaoh's power can produce some wonders, but there's no instances here where his powers produce improvement. God, on the other hand, he can bring chaos, but he can also bring order. He controls both. He controls it all. There are a number of references to Pharaoh's hardness of heart as we proceed through here. His heart remains hard throughout. God had said that Pharaoh's heart would be hardened. And as we proceed through, that is definitely the case. That's repeated with each plague. Interestingly, there are three grammatical constructions that are used to describe Pharaoh's hardness of heart. One construction is Pharaoh hardened his heart. A second construction is in the passive voice, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And the third is God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And of about 16 occurrences of one of those constructions, in early in the narrative, it is always one of the first two. That is, either Pharaoh hardened his heart or Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And it mixes those about half and half. As we get into the second half of the narrative, it is consistently God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And I think it's clear that God is behind Pharaoh's hardening heart all along. That's what God had said even before this narrative begins, is that he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart. But we see a progression as we go through the plagues. Early on, it's Pharaoh who's hardening his heart, but at a certain point, the narrative switches to saying God hardened his heart. And I think what that's depicting is a situation in which, and you've probably seen this kind of thing, where someone who is bent on evil, at some point it becomes out of control and completely irrational. I don't know how many of you have seen the documentary on O.J. Simpson called Made in America. I highly recommend it. It's very interesting, just as a commentary on American society over that period of time. So I recommend it for a number of reasons. But one of the things that struck me about that commentary and that's relevant here is in the depiction that they give of O.J. Simpson, for the most part, he's a decent guy for much of the documentary. But there comes a point in time in his trial where there is a significant change in his demeanor. And then you see a deterioration of his character, a very visible deterioration of his character from then on. My suspicion is that the narrative here is capturing the same kind of phenomenon, that after a certain point, Pharaoh's behavior becomes absolutely inexplicable. His stubbornness becomes absolutely inexplicable. Okay, why doesn't Pharaoh recognize that God is who he is, that Yahweh is who he is? I think there are three things that keep Pharaoh from doing that. The first is his culture and his experience. All of Egyptian society was built around the assumption that the Pharaoh is a god. He is to be worshipped, and he's the one who keeps us in order, keeps us out of chaos. So Pharaoh's military is the strongest in the world. When he sends his army out to fight somebody, they beat him up. So his experience is telling him that he is great and powerful. All of the people in the court, all of his culture is saying, you're a god, you're great and you're powerful. And with all of those forces saying that, it would be difficult for someone in Pharaoh's position to not believe it. Secondly, since the society is all ordered around the assumption that he is God, that even if he wanted to admit that Yahweh was the one true God, even if he wanted to admit that, to renounce his position of supremacy would be so disruptive to society that the change would be inconceivable. It couldn't be done. And the third thing is, he doesn't want it to be true. He doesn't want it to be true that Yahweh is the one true God and he, Pharaoh, is but a creature. Like everyone, he wanted to be God. We all want to be God. We all want to be able to order the universe around us. We all relish that power and think to one degree or another that we have that power. As a result, what needs to happen here is Pharaoh needs to be humbled. Pharaoh needs to come to the place that he recognizes that he is nothing but a creature, and God is the one true God, the maker of us all. And that's what's going to happen through this narrative of the plagues. Pharaoh is going to be indeed humbled. Okay, there's a little time for questions, comments.
There's a lot here.
Yeah.
I mean, once you start reading and unpacking it, they're on so many levels. It seems to me that one of the things Pharaoh accomplishes by having his magicians do the same is to let the people know that we can do this to you. And so it's not just brotherhood and loyalty mm-hmm. that keeps them in line. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that we tick off Pharaoh, he can hurt us. Mm-hmm. He has the power of the gods on his mm-hmm. side. But these mm-hmm. guys come along. Mm-hmm. Apparently they too have the power of the gods.
Yeah.
So the people are also watching this battle, wanting to know, well, who's in charge when this is all over and how mm-hmm. are they going to treat us?
Could be. Yeah. Could be. I was thinking about this. There's another interesting feature there. Just before this section, it talks about Moses being as God to Aaron, and Aaron will be as a prophet to the people. So we've got Moses is God, Aaron is spokesman, and then we've got the people. On the other hand, we've got Pharaoh as God. We have magicians as the ones who do his bidding, and then the people. So we do have a couple of triads here, I think, that are being compared.
And when he says, stretch out your staff, because God originally says nine. But then it goes to ponds and reservoirs and streams.
Right.
I mean, basically
all water.
Yeah. So, I mean, was that just sort of the Nile? They knew it all came from the Nile anyway? Or, because when they went to dig wells,
right.
Did they assume they were digging into the Nile's aquifer?
I would think so, but I don't know for sure. Just as a comment, I think when it says it turns into blood, that we're just talking about the color. I don't think it's type O negative or something, but it's just turning up blood red. But why blood? Why use, there are other things that are red that could have been used. Why the color of blood? That's one of the, I'm confident that's significant. I'm not sure what the significance is.
And David, are the Israelites experiencing all this also? Because it says over the land. And
right. With these three plagues, that's not clear. Later on, it makes it clear that the Israelites are not subject to this. My assumption is that these three plagues are experienced by the whole of Egypt, including where the Israelites are living. But it does not make that clear.
I always thought that no way that somebody could turn all the water in Egypt red. I mean, some musician or whatever. So I always thought that on some of this, when they said that they could do the same thing, that it was just an example, a small example or whatever. Same thing with the frogs and things. Mm-hmm. The rest of it doesn't, that just seems so far out as far as, it seems like it has to be a supernatural thing, and I don't think some musician would even be able to come close to that. The other thing is, I think it'd be interesting to see, as far as you're thinking that this is possible, instead of being a supernatural event, that it might be just some way initiating a natural event, which makes a maybe a lot more sense. I know that I've always thought, how in the world could you, I haven't seen the Nile, but I've seen the Amazon, and that's a lot of water, and there's a lot of fish in there, and so just the idea that all the fish died would be a mess. And there's no, I just don't see how Pharaoh could say it's not a big deal unless it was something that had happened before or something that the people had. How would you even not revolt as a people? Water is a pretty significant resource that you can't get along very, very long without. And so, you know, there's just some things there that don't make a whole lot of sense unless it's something that people maybe had seen before. I know the locusts. When I was a kid, I had an uncle that was a farmer in Nebraska, and it was not unusual. They fight grasshoppers like mad. Mm-hmm. And it was not unusual for grasshoppers to come in and just wipe out a crop overnight.
Right.
And
right.
So
I'll have much more to say about this after you get through all the plagues. But there is a hypothesis that has been advanced that these plagues are all naturally occurring things. In fact, they come in this order because this is the progression in which they would happen naturally. But these happen on a much grander scale than was observable. We have Egyptian literature that refers to several of these plagues, and it's literature that's proclaiming a curse on someone. It's made of, I can't remember how, but it, may this happen to you. May the water turn to blood, and may frogs be in your bathtub and stuff like that. So these presumably are not unprecedented occurrences, like you say, but they are happening. There are two things that are significant about them. One is on a grander scale than we have any knowledge of them happening. And secondly, at the command of God, at God's timing, and that's what makes them miraculous, rather than violation of the rules of physics and chemistry. That we'll talk more about that.
What's weird about gnats? Why couldn't they make gnats?
Why couldn't they?
Yeah,
can you make gnats?
Well, I mean, how hard is it to do a magic trick? It was just how I always imagined it as a kid. It's can you make gnats appear? And suddenly, look, like the room's full of gnats.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be difficult to try. So what are the magicians doing that they can't make gnats?
I don't.
Because they literally lose it at that point. They go, we are done, we are out. Count us out of the rest. Because
we can't do
gnats.
We do mosquitoes. We can't do that.
I make gnats magically appear on my fridge or on my pantry shelf without trying.
I don't know, but my suspicion is that they have a certain bag of tricks. There are certain things that they can do and pull off in a way that's more or less compelling, and that this number three is one that's not in their bag of tricks. I'm just assuming that that's the case. But the first two were in their bag of tricks.
So, and then there's also this idea of a precedent for some of these occurrences having happened before to the Egyptians, perhaps on a lesser scale, and definitely not with someone saying, God's doing this and it's going to stop at such and such time.
Right.
Do you think that maybe what they're doing is they're saying, we can produce this in the sense that our gods have done this to us before? Like, this isn't so grand because Imhotep has turned our Nile red before because of poor sacrificing.
Most of these plagues involve one of the gods of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
There are two or three of them where it's not clear that they're, for instance, the god of gnats. We are aware of a god of gnats. But I think it's pretty clear that part of what's happening here is a polemic against the gods of Egypt. That is to say, you worship the god of the Nile, but I, Yahweh, can turn that to blood. Turn it to blood such that it no longer provides what the Nile needs to provide for you to live. So I'm pretty sure that that's part of what's going on here, is a polemic. But some version of all of these plagues, except the 10th one, we'll have to talk about that more, but some version of all of these plagues is recorded in history as having happened in Egypt. Some of them, many of them in historic times. So, yeah.
So why that kind of interested me was, you're saying, I'm assuming you're going to say that these plagues follow a natural progression of the way biology ecosystems work.
Right.
So if the Nile had turned red before, and if frogs had come and then died, gnats would have come as well in their past. So, no more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just the natural phenomenon. In Pakistan in the spring, we would get so many frogs that I'd have 20 on my bedroom floor, and if you didn't have the light on, you'd crush them. And it was interesting because different insects would hatch sometimes. We had two or three times in 30 years, a different insect would just absolutely overwhelm us and fill the house.
Right.
And then 5 years later, it would be a different insect. It was kind of like they had a certain year that they just came out.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
right.
Those kinds of things were really unusual to see.
Right. And that's, when I talk about the hypothesis as to how these fit together, given just the right set of circumstances, these are the ones that would naturally happen. You don't always have gnats after the Nile turns red, for instance. It kind of depends on some, but they've put together a succession of events that would account for all of these plagues.
I think it's easy for us to think how foolish Pharaoh is, you know, he keeps changing his mind and getting hardening his heart. I see that in myself a lot. But the part that puzzles me is when he finally tells Moses to get rid of the frogs, and Moses says, okay, when? Why does he say tomorrow? Why doesn't he just say right now?
Yeah, I don't know. There are a lot of mysterious things in this section. But with respect to the difficulty of Pharaoh recognizing what's really going on, we need to recognize, like you say, we all feel that to a large extent, that giving up our control, recognizing we are just creatures in, like, putty in the hands of our maker, rather than thinking, we are the shapers of our own reality. We are masters of our own universe. That's a significant demotion, and that's a hard demotion to face into, and that's the struggle we all face. If Pharaoh becomes kind of a, there's a sense in which he's kind of a caricature here, he becomes a caricature, but there's another sense in which he's just doing the thing that we all do. It's just so hard to give that up and to be humbled in the way that we need to be humbled before our Maker.
He expresses more patience than I would have.
God does, absolutely.
I never noticed before that his magicians did it by their secret arts.
Right.
I never noticed that before.
Right.
The thing that occurred to me is that with the Nile, if, for example, it's some kind of algae bloom that turns the water red or something like that, if they've had enough experience with that, and if they have the apparatus in place, like people upstream who can
right.
say that algae bloom is beginning
right.
and can get a message down to these priests, then these priests can go out and do whatever their mumbo jumbo is.
Exactly.
And lo and behold, the water turns red, and it creates that illusion of control and power and so on.
Right.
Perhaps the same thing with the frogs, but lo and behold, the nets, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. That's why it's so significant when Moses says, name the time that you want the frogs to die. Now he's given Pharaoh the option of giving the time. The magicians are never going to say, you tell me when you want the water to turn red. Because they're doing it on knowledge that other people don't have. I'm sure that's the case.
That's very interesting.
Okay. Thanks.